Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we are giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music. Hey, welcome to the 119th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. I'm Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Enlow. Today we've got Jeffrey Giles from Automatic Entertainment. We're going to talk all about what sales reps do. He's a sales rep for Automatic Entertainment, so he breaks down the ways in which he assesses a film. They sell movies all over the world, and they become a part of those projects at every different phase of production. So they'll take a look at scripts, they'll take a look at movies halfway through, they'll take a look at movies at film festivals. And so he's going to break down the ways in which he determines whether or not Automatic wants to be a part of a project or not, and what a sales rep is thinking about in general when they're assessing a project.
Right. Automatic Entertainment is the company that distributed my first movie, The Hammer. And so after we made the movie, we met these guys, Jeffrey and Michael at Automatic, and they took our movie and sold it to the entire world. I think this is a real deep dive on what makes people want to sell your movie. The answers are surprising at times.
It's a great conversation if you want to make a movie.
Yeah. If you have any interest in making movies, listen to this.
This is a nice lengthy conversation, so we're going to skip our catch up this time around. But stay tuned out next episode because, Oren, I'm sure you've got all sorts of interesting stories from the battlefield that we'll talk about next episode.
Yes, I've gone to battle many times.
This episode was brought to you by patron Oscar Vaca. Thanks, Oscar.
If you want to support the show, check us out at patreon.com/justshootitpod.
Yeah, drop us a buck or four or more, but, you know, a buck or four is fine. Now let's have our conversation with Jeffrey Giles of Automatic Entertainment.
Okay, hey guys, we are here with Jeffrey Giles from Automatic Entertainment.
That's me.
Automatic with a C, not a K.
Right off the bat.
Well, there is an Automatic with a K, right?
There is.
And they also make movies.
And we get their Christmas gift boxes.
That's excellent.
That's okay.
Yeah.
We probably get about one call every other day.
So what do you, can you just give us like a brief rundown of what Automatic Entertainment does?
Automatic with a C.
Automatic with a C. A sales rep is like any, you know, company that has a product and needs to sell it. A sales rep in our business finds movies, helps produce movies, helps finance movies, and then takes it out into the marketplace, domestic, international.
Mm-hmm. Like AFM and Cannes and those types of places.
Yeah, takes it to the markets, takes it to the festivals, and gets the movie sold, gets the movie out in front of distributors.
And you distribute both domestically and internationally. So you're selling all of the different markets.
Well, there's a different, let's unpack what you just said, which is we distribute. We don't essentially distribute. Automatic is not a distribution company. We have a distribution arm. We have, we have a company that we've set up to handle distribution. But that is not Automatic Entertainment.
Right. I suppose you sell to distributors.
So
is that accurate?
Automatic's sole responsibility, like our, you know, our mission statement would basically be to find movies, sell them for the highest price we possibly can.
And sell them to whom?
To distributors.
To
companies, to people that want to put movies in front of an audience.
Mm-hmm. And so my experience with Automatic is my first movie, The Hammer, they were the international sales reps on it. And at least I'm probably giving like the not super accurate version of this, but the way I remember our interaction is that you guys watch the movie, you say, okay, we're willing to sell it. you give us a list of territories. Here's like all these countries that we're going to try to sell the movie to. Here's the minimum amount that we expect to make from this country, and here's the maximum amount. Mm-hmm.
There are terms for that, right? What are the terms? It's like the ask and the buy. Is that
the ask and the take?
And the take. There you go.
Yeah. Those are
There's a lot of jargon in that world that like can make your head spin a little bit. So it's worth kind of checking every once in a while. Ask and take is just the min and the max, basically.
So basically, you say for Lithuania, we're going to ask for $10,000, but we'll take $500, right? Something like that.
Sure. I
mean, it depends on the movie, depends on the cast, depends on everything, depends on if the territory even cares, right? You're not going to sell a Christmas movie in Saudi Arabia.
You'd be surprised.
Really?
what can be sold or bought in today's marketplace. I guess, the reason why I'm kind of staying like a little bit quiet or hesitant like for this part of a conversation is because what you guys are describing and what we did on the Hammer, even though that was what, 2011?
10, 11.
That's old. Like,
oh, really?
It is just an old way of doing business. In general, like, if I'm advising somebody from the outset who's doing this for the very first time, looking back at those old methods of how to get a deal and how to go about, constructing your deal and asking for things like estimates and whatnot, there's no harm in it. But if you're making a movie and you don't know what it's worth from the outset, then you probably need to go back and think about what the hell you're actually doing.
Yeah, so that's a really great piece of advice just right off the bat, right? I think that a lot of our listeners and a lot of people who are dreaming about making that first feature, they've got a story inside them. And they've got to get it out. This is their dream. They want to make this movie. And the thought of what is this movie worth? What's its value to Lithuania or whomever else? Isn't a question that they're asking themselves yet. Because like there's so much of like, well, if it's good, people will want to see it.
Right.
So let's take a step back. How would someone even come to terms with what they think their film is worth in your eyes?
I think it starts out with the idea in the first place. And, we're in a weird position as a sales agent, as entity that shepherds an expectation, because that's really what it is that we do. Mm-hmm. We're in the business of expectation management.
That's funny. I thought you were just selling people's movies.
Right. I mean, but if I approached my Lithuanian buyer with a movie that's essentially marketable, like Taken, and I'm asking the same price that was asked for the movie Taken, like that's a mismanagement of an expectation from the intermediary to the client. And if I've set that expectation up from the producer to me as the intermediary, then the whole process is broken. So it's about like our job is about managing expectations. I think when it comes to determining value, we have some preconceived notions, but it's so important for the filmmakers before I think they type the end at the end of their screenplay to know what type of value they're actually looking to extract from this process of making a movie, because who among two men defines success in the same way, right? So if your version of success is I'm going to go make my movie about my, a dying family member, and I'm going to pour all my heart and passion into it, and it's going to be this really intimate story, and it's going to be super powerful, and it's for an audience of one, me, and you just have to tell this story because it's so deeply rooted in you, and it ends up becoming Nebraska,
sure. Well done.
Well, it's but like, is that is, you know, what did you set out to do? Mm-hmm. Did you set out to win an Academy Award, or did you set out to make a movie about you know, something that was super personal and, mm-hmm. and what's the word? Intrinsic to you, you know, mm-hmm. proprietary.
Right.
I think the real thing is understanding the value of success, right? Mm-hmm. And how you define success from the outset. That's the most important thing, because there are the people that we meet who will put pictures on a radar or projects on a radar, and they define success as we're going to make this for one, and I want you guys to sell it for three. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Right. And you're saying like 1 million and 3 million, right? Just to be clear.
Well, in terms of we're going to make it for 100 and sell it for 300, we're going to make it for 1 million and 3 million, you know, mm-hmm. we're going to make it for a price and we're going to sell it for a profit, wherein the sales agency makes money. I've left hopefully some money on the table for the distributors so that they're going to make money in their own territory. And all of this, you know, gets an ROI financial, you know, ROI back mm-hmm. to the guy who put up the first money in the first place.
Right.
Something that maybe is not clear to people is, I'm sure some people are listening and going like, well, I don't want to make like Sharknado, you know, I don't want to just like
don't do make this genre. And do make Sharknado, you know, there's nothing wrong with Sharknado. Yeah.
But sometimes like the Sundance laurels can be just as marketable as the genre or the Jason Statham
Absolutely.
Cast, right? Like, can you walk us through like some of the things that you guys see in a movie that make you feel like you're going to be able to set high expectations and meet them?
Or even just, you know, I mean, I think there's the criteria of like, oh, we want to take this project on, or, oh, it's not for us. What are some of the consistent things that you have seen that make you excited for a project and feel like it's going to be successful in everyone's terms?
If I could boil that down to one word, it would be contribution. Mm-hmm. It would be a movie that contributes to the artistic community, you know, so it pushes the envelope, it pushes the genre, it contributes to what we're all trying to do here, which is make something, you know, special and unique. Mm-hmm. Because arguably even the Sharknado, you know, like nobody sets out to make a bad movie. I love the guys at the Asylum. They're good friends. They'll be the first ones to back their projects. Nobody sets out to make a terrible movie. The batting average is high, it seems like. So, in terms of contribution, like if it's something that inspires people, you know, mm-hmm. or inspires other artists, or that's first and foremost, I think, important. And then it, as Automatic, if it contributes to distribution, because mm-hmm. distribution and the artist community, as much as they are interlinked, they're really not. I don't sell movies to consumers. You know, A24 mm-hmm. puts a movie in front of consumers. I sell, and A24 sales team, like they're positioning their movies or our movies to buyers, you know, and it's a completely different psychology. It's mm-hmm. a completely different process. It's, you know, to equate it to something I guess more tangible would be like car lots. I don't sell the car to the consumer. I sell the package of cars to the dealership.
Uh-huh.
You know,
sure.
And then the dealership knows, oh, you know, my consumers in my territory, in my region, like they prefer mm-hmm. you know, Ford Focuses, whatever, like
right.
We need more Ford Focuses. So if I can contribute to that community mm-hmm. by selling more Ford Focuses, then great, you know,
right.
If that's what people want.
So what are you seeing buyers want today?
Ford Focuses.
They definitely are looking for...
just like a smart economy car. It's got a great...
Yeah, good gas trunk, mileage.
Good,
yeah.
Great gas mileage, yeah. Maybe... backup camera.
But
when I met with you guys last week,
yeah,
what Michael said was like, he didn't say this in these words, but what the sense I got was like a slow burn type of movie is not something that's easy to sell.
Well, Michael's my partner. I love the guy. and we have wildly different opinions on these things. Speaking of A24, Hereditary is arguably a slow burn picture. Any Kubrick picture is arguably a slow burn picture.
But it's a Kubrick picture.
Right. Does that mean it's an Ari Aster? Is that how you say his name?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Picture? Like, you know.
Well, that's a Toni Collette film, I guess.
Right. Like, this is my point.
Amazing,
like,
trailer.
Would you have picked up Hereditary? Would you have been like, oh, we're going to sell this movie?
Expectation. What's the expectation? Mm-hmm. You know, has that been aligned?
Expectation, I think, makes a ton of sense. But I think that there's also gonna be a listener out there that's like, hey man, I just want to get my movie on Lithuanian Netflix, and I'm not that worried about making my money back because I only spent $75,000 that I got from my grandma.
Sure. Let's say that $75,000 movie's a masterpiece, though. Mm-hmm. Like, it's, you know, Tartakovsky. It's mm-hmm. it's Kubrick. It's just a genuine masterpiece of filmmaking. But what your question kind of presupposes is that quality is somehow tied to financials. Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely not. Just because, Hereditary is made for probably a net $5 million, maybe even less, and it grosses whatever it's at, 36 in the box office now. Like, is that financial success? A24 could tell you, but I would think in some ways that margin for financial success, just based on what I know about distribution, and I'm still learning every day, so full disclaimer there, but I would guess that margin is actually pretty thin.
Interesting. Interesting.
So again, it's like, would your question, would I like to sell Hereditary? I would love to sell good movies. Mm-hmm. But I've sold, you know, the Sharknados of the world, and they arguably can make more money and thicker financial mm-hmm. margins mm-hmm. than something like the Hereditaries of the world.
Right.
We've sold movies out of South by Southwest and Sundance and Toronto. And it's not always this way, of course not, but sometimes those movies can sell like way less than Jurassic Galaxy. Like, like, you know, but so again, this is about like defining success.
Right.
There's zero correlation between being a good movie and selling for a high number, uh-huh. or being a good movie and being broadly distributable, or that distribution guarantees money in any sort of way.
Right.
Just because you have the mechanism to put a movie in front of an audience doesn't mean it's going to, you know, the audience mm-hmm. is going to transact.
Like, what makes a movie easy for you to sell? That it premiered at Sundance, does that help?
No, because we've taken a look at movies like Katie Goes Home or something like this. You know, the girl that was in the Spielberg Ready Player One. It was mm-hmm. Percival and then the girl.
Yeah, yeah.
I forget her name. But anyway, like Katie Goes Home stars this girl.
Right.
We took a look at that movie and it was interesting. There was an exploitive angle, but that was the wrong angle to play on this picture because it was trying to be sweet and genuine and grounded. And if we encouraged the filmmakers to market it in an exploitive way, it probably could have done more business. Mm-hmm. But we looked at that and we were just like, this, it's just a misaligned expectation, you know? And so
unpack that, though. You said a misaligned expectation. You mean that they think that their movie is worth more than you see the potential for sales?
Well, I can't speak to what they thought because I don't know what their goal was. But because they were working with an agency intermediary, like one of the big agencies. That's really how it works if you're premiering at a festival, one of the big agencies, WME, CAA, ICM, they're going to try and latch onto your project and rep your project and then sell it to guys like us mm-hmm. who then have to sell it to guys like, you know, the buyer base, the international domestic buyer base. So we have to sell it to the salesman, and then the salesman sell it to the consumers. Mm-hmm. So it's just a bunch of fucking hands feeding hands, you know, before the money actually goes back to the filmmakers. So we never were in touch directly with the filmmakers on that project, but, you know, but that's, that picture is probably more representative than of the average situation than not. Uh-huh. Is that, like, you'll hear about Hereditary coming out of Sundance. You'll hear about, you know, Source Code coming out of South, we're premiering at South by Southwest. You'll hear about these premieres and these big deal premieres. But there's tens of hundreds of movies at these festivals that you never hear about. They, you know, they just kind of silently float into distribution. We've touched some of those pictures. Mm-hmm. And it's always nice as a sales agent to have a picture that has accreditation to it, that has, you know, festival validation to it. It's an easy pitch bullet, mm-hmm, to send, you know, out to our buyer base and say, hey, you know, this just premiered at South by Southwest. Look at the initial reviews. Here are some, you know, blurbs. But it doesn't guarantee sales, mm-hmm, you know.
And well, do the buyers watch the movie always? Is that, and I know that's a silly question, but no, right, because people pre-sell movies just, right off posters and Jean-Claude Van Damme being in them.
Well,
or does that not happen anymore?
I think buyers watch movies at festivals, and that's why the festivals have become kind of the breeding ground for deals that they've actually become in the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. You know, there was always festivals, like especially Sundance, have been important, you know, for decades, right? You know, and you heard those stories of Harvey Weinstein, mm-hmm, you know, running down, sure, filmmakers with, right, a check in his hand and telling them to sign on the dotted line. I mean, that's nothing really new. But really, like since 2000, we've seen since 2010, that's when the agencies really started to, like the talent agencies, that's when they really started to get involved, mm-hmm, in being intermediaries to sales agencies or to distributors, because they were looking at these little movies, these, mm-hmm, you know, sub-million-dollar movies, these SAG modified low budget pictures, and they were saying, "Oh my God, you know, we can go sell this movie for $500K. Mm-hmm. Well, that's, you know, 10% margin. Great, you know, right, that helps pay for this person's salary, or this, right, you know, this desk,
or this our trip to Sundance,
phone, or gas in this guy's jet, whatever." Yeah. Like, you know, so they were looking at all these pictures, and there was a market that was really built, you know, out of, mm-hmm, transacting these pictures. But it's a market of falsehoods in some ways, because for every, you know, for every Turbo Kid, mm-hmm, there's a Katie Goes Home. There's right, a picture that just premieres and is okay, and it's fine, and it's got the guy from that show Girls, and who cares? You know, right, I'll watch it for quote unquote free when it hits Netflix. If, right, it hits Netflix, oh shit, it didn't hit Netflix. Well, I'm on to, yeah, the next season of Glow anyway. So, yeah,
right, Glow's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah,
I can't wait for.
It's real good. It's,
yeah. I like Glow.
Well, so even though it's an old example, The Hammer, which came out in 2011, I think we dealt directly with you guys, right?
Yeah.
Our producers, yeah, Joe and Evan. Like you said, as filmmakers, you're expecting to make like 10 times the amount of money you put in, because everyone on set is so passionate about the movie. You think that the whole world is going to be that passionate about it. And then, yeah, you realize, well, the whole world doesn't, sure, didn't work on the movie.
Well, and to be fair, also, like, even when you screen it at film festivals, that's a self-selecting audience. So it's like, of course, the people there are going to respond to it a little bit more than the, you know, yeah, mainstream at large, right?
It's its,
right,
own sort of, yeah, that's an insulated viewing experience.
Right.
It is unique. I would say the vast majority of people outside of the festival experience are watching movies on their laptop.
And not watching independent films, to be,
yeah,
honest, right? But so we had kind of two big interesting sales through you guys. Mm-hmm. One was you guys sold our like airline cruise ship rates, whatever those
ancillaries
are called.
Yeah.
Yeah, which we had, I think we made a decent amount of money on those, and it's not even like a territory I think a lot of filmmakers think of.
That was a good deal.
It's also a surprising treat Like right. our previous guest, Morgan Dameron, her movie was on United or Virgin or something. Mm-hmm. And I texted her a picture and she was like, yeah, it just came out this week. And like we've talked about it since. It's like such a delight for people to just be like, oh my God, your movie. Because they're a captive audience too. You know,
true,
it's different. It's a different reaction than even like a Netflix or something.
But that example is a really good like proof of or validation of what I've been saying in terms of a picture that contributes. Because while that picture didn't have, while Hammer didn't have, you know, exceptional cast, it was an exceptional looking movie. By all means, it should win Academy Awards compared to the vast majority of the pictures that I see, which is a real credit to you, Oren. But, but that movie works for ancillary sales because it appeals to a family. Mm-hmm. It's non-offensive. It contributed to that buyer's like ecosystem of movies.
Right.
They could then present it because again, like even then, that buyer is not selling to the, you know, the person that buys a ticket on United. They're selling to the United mm-hmm. Airlines, you know, programmer who is looking at a swath of content this quarter and saying, well, I'll take, you know, Equalizer 2 and yeah, mm-hmm. I'll take all the season, you know, two seasons of Glow and okay, I need 20 movies in my family bucket. Mm-hmm. What are the family movies? And then, you know, the ancillary sales companies, they go and they present, you know, here are all of our mm-hmm. independent family movies. And Hammer just like it checked the box, you know.
Right. I think it's a movie that if you watch it on an airplane and the person next to you sees your screen, you're never like embarrassed or squeamish, right? It's like it's PG-13, but it's on the edge of PG.
I watched Girl with a Dragon Tattoo on a plane once,
but it was probably edited for the airlines, right?
Maybe it was on Virgin. So
right, well, let's do this. What's the worst captive movie experience you've had on an airplane? Like you watched it and you were like, this was probably not.
Probably Girl with a Dragon Tattoo. With a Dragon. Yeah.
Well, I watched, Kara and I watched Homeland, which there's like a big sex scene and we're like turning the iPad screen around so that the kids next to us don't see it. But I watched, I think, Chef, that Jon Favreau movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
sure.
And I was like crying. At the end of it, I was like so moved, and I was like so embarrassed.
You're like gonna like start a food truck and
hiding my eyes because I didn't want people on the airplane to see that I was like getting teary eyed watching a movie.
I think there's something though about watching a movie on an airplane that your emotions are heightened in a way. Sure. I cry constantly on the airplane while watching movies. I cried during Captain Phillips. It was the first time I watched that movie, and yeah. That was a tough one. Yeah.
So I think the Hammer probably
caused some people to cry on there.
Definitely.
Oh, I hope.
Yeah.
Not me.
Like, get me off this plane.
I mean, I got nerves of steel.
But the other surprising sale we had is we had like a pretty good sale in Latin America.
Yeah.
Which was totally unrelated to the, I mean, maybe it was related to the family nature of it, but at the time, Matt Hamill, who the movie was about, was a UFC fighter.
Yeah.
And in Latin America, UFC was very popular, right? Was that, or at least that's what I kind of assumed was part of why
it was a pitch bullet, definitely. But the reason that sale occurred was because there are sometimes in the business trigger sales that you can capitalize on if you have a title that performs at a certain level or has a certain type of release. So for example, Hammer did, I forget what it was at the time. It was either it did over $1 million in box office or it was released on over 100 screens.
Yeah, it was the 100 screen thing because you guys asked us to send you like the list of screens or something.
So yeah, so we could quantify that information for the buyer. The buyer then would be able to present that information to their TV network or, mm-hmm. you know, Netflix, whatever. And they could say, well, here's my list of bona fide theatrical titles. And then here's my other stuff. Mm-hmm. And because your title performed at a certain level, they were able to meet a quota for a sale in their territory. So that one worked out.
Right. That's the one very rare example of when a theatrical actually matters for an independent film.
But I'll give you an example. Like, as beneficial as that was for that sale, there are negative triggers also. Like, for example, I'm almost 100% positive we did not sell that title to France.
Yeah.
But that's because France has an embargo against titles that perform theatrically in their territory of origin. Doesn't matter if you're from the UK or from the US or Canada. If you're in theaters in your territory of origin, France says, no, thank you.
Is that right?
We will program our own picture.
Is that, that's true. So like Star Wars opens here.
The studio pictures are different.
Gotcha.
Because the studios have massive distribution streams across the world. So, but for independent pictures, China, parts of Eastern Bloc, France, this is an issue. So like as beneficial as that sale was, you know, one could argue, well, like, you know, what was the profit that was derived out of North America based on that theatrical release? Did you make any, did you actually make any money off that? I'm not asking you to answer it. I'm just saying like, but that's an important thing. Like, did you make money off that 100 screen release? And if you didn't, how much more money could we have made had we been able to sell it to France?
And so let me ask,
but then how much money could we have lost from Latin America, or could we have sold it for the same amount and just, you know,
not had that trigger.
Exactly.
Yeah. What about, like a VOD or like a transactional, like streaming release only, would that allow you to still sell to?
Yeah. So if it bypasses theaters and it goes straight to what we call home entertainment, if it's a home entertainment release, then that's fine. But like day and dates become extremely, you can find yourself in a predicament on a day and date. You know, it's a, like we were talking with Saban today, you know, they do day and date on a lot of their pictures, 10 theaters, whatever, 20 theaters. And, you know, a picture like Shot Caller, as great as that movie is, like that picture will be almost unsellable in France or in China. Not necessarily because of the content, but because it was theatrically released.
Right.
I don't think that movie's really going to be a big sale in those territories.
It's kind of a calculated risk. But, yeah. Interesting.
But yeah.
So
it's a factor.
Yeah.
It's a factor.
Yeah. So, so Matt is putting together a movie right now, right?
Congratulations. Yes.
Thank you.
It's a great thing.
Yeah. It feels good.
And it's, like under $1 million.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Well under a million.
So let's call it SAG modified.
Yeah. You could even call it ULB.
SAG Ultra.
Yeah.
Okay. Is it going to be a union picture? Are you going to do SAG?
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why? Yes, definitely.
Because of the talent attached.
Got it.
Yeah. And also you just want good actors.
So the only the good actors are in SAG?
I don't want to hate.
The very experienced actors are in SAG.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, and I think also even let's take the quantitative of like good or bad out of it. I think the talent of a certain level that you were describing before all happen to be SAG, or not happen to be, are explicitly SAG.
Okay.
Right? Would you disagree? Is that an assumption I'm making that's incorrect?
Can you name a great actor that's not SAG?
No. Not great. Recognizable in a moderate capacity.
John Voight.
He's not SAG.
He's FICOR, which means he can do in a non-union, right? But
you know what I mean? Like, oh, that guy from that TV show.
I do.
That means they're SAG.
Well, let's, you know, I love talking. Like, I'm going on a rabbit hole here.
But is there an advantage to go non-union for sales?
You have to. It's something to take into consideration. I think there, you know, depending on your budget size, there's just as many reasons to not go union as there are to go union. If your talent pool demands it, but if your talent pool doesn't demand it, or what you're trying to do doesn't demand SAG actors, and your budget is so low, there's implications. Once you pay a SAG actor on set, you pay them for their on-set work. But as soon as your movie gets into distribution, you have to pay that actor again. Mm-hmm. SAG takes a what's called a first position security interest in your picture. So they are your number one investor, mm-hmm. Whether you like it or not. So if your picture gets distributed and the public transacts on it, and you made nothing through that distribution mm-hmm. because the expenses for distribution were so high, whatever. Let's say you signed a terrible deal and the distributor gets to keep all this money, but you get zero. But still, it went your little $100,000 movie mm-hmm. went and transacted $450,000 in North America. SAG doesn't care whether you made nothing and signed a terrible deal. They care that people watched actors in their union. Mm-hmm. And so they will tax you for the $450,000 that was transacted. You can't pay it. Well, we have a first position security interest in your movie. So, right.
So then what happens then?
So then SAG basically owns your picture. And that's what happens with when you sign with this type of union. And it's not a bad thing. It's just, it's part of the game.
It definitely happened to us on The Hammer. Like all of a sudden we got some big check and we were all excited. Ooh, let's pay out the investors. And then Eben's like, SAG just called me. We need to send them $40,000.
Yeah.
Like, oh, like, where did that come from? He's like, I don't know. I guess.
Well, so this would be, this would be my first piece of advice to you, you know, on your, you know, UBL to modified low is, it would be very wise for you to carve out a portion of your actual production budget mm-hmm. for SAG down the road.
Oh, interesting.
And that's just like, put that money in an account, store it, mm-hmm. you know, save it for that rainy day. But this also feeds into the very beginning of this conversation, which is you should generally know the value of your picture before you start.
Sure.
Like, you know.
So how does Matt figure out the value of his picture, let's say?
Well, the easiest thing is what's your picture like?
Mm-hmm. Like, what's the genre?
What's the genre?
No, yeah. Like name another movie that.
Oh, interesting. Blue Ruin is not, or like Brick.
Okay, but Blue Ruin's kind of a lightning in a bottle because Harvey Weinstein did chase Jeremy down with a check, or Film Science, his agent, down with a check and, you know, before the movie had even completed, I think. And
Blue Ruin is much more gory and violent.
It's more gory or violent. But, so basically.
So it's a slow burn.
No, it's not. I don't want to talk too much about it.
Which is tricky.
We can talk about one of my projects too.
I'm just saying, like, hypothetically, this is the important thing to think about is like, what's the other movie that my movie is like? Because, right, that's the Hollywood mm-hmm. adage is like,
do the same thing,
only different, right?
So I think it's easy to say that it is a neo-noir, right? It's like, it's a mumblecore thriller. Right, so you take the puffy chair and you take Blue Ruin, you mix them together,
yeah,
and that's this movie.
I know what Michael would be doing. He'd probably be like,
sure, great.
But I'm cool with like, these are
funny thriller is not a crazy pitch.
No, it's not a crazy pitch. It's execution dependent. It's going to be a calling card of proving ground. If you can pull this thing off in a seamless manner, and
by the way, Matt is not the director; he's the producer on it.
Yeah, but you still have to ask your question. Like, you still need to internalize: what is my movie like? Mm-hmm. Where's it going to perform? And what distribution has been done on these types of movies? So they aren't in business anymore, but getting, you know, TWC Radius mm-hmm. to pay you, you know, an exorbitant amount of money for the distribution rights to your picture in North America, like that's lightning, you know, premiering at Cannes is lightning in a bottle. They were turned down by Sundance, you know, and even in their, you know.
You're talking about Blue Ruin.
Yeah, even in their interviews, they were like, I'm like, you know, we got in. It was an amazing, like, we totally didn't expect it, you know, so like.
Right.
It was a lottery ticket. And then that lottery ticket was compounded by the fact that, you know, the major independent distributor in the world validated this movie for release.
Well, let me ask you this then, though, because so, you know, you say what is your movie like? And someone walks in they kind of only have movies that we've all heard of at their disposal, right?
Sure,
you wouldn't recommend saying like, well, you know, a movie that did fine that we, you know, that you don't know, right? Like, what should someone say? Say I walked in and I was like, I've got a gory thriller with no stars in it that I know is really good. That's Blue Ruin, right? So
yeah,
then what do you say?
As a business, as the agent or as the Weinstein Company, unless you are Quentin Tarantino,
sure,
or at this stage, Jeremy Saulnier.
Saulnier.
Like, unless you're a proven talent, I'd be like, fantastic, man. I can't wait to see it, because that is an execution dependent
right
scenario.
Right. What's a non-execution dependent scenario?
Sharknado. I love Sharknado.
But
it so depends on what your goals are and what your ambitions are as a filmmaker. Because if you're setting out to do, you know, Blue Ruin meets Puffy Chair, mm-hmm, like you're not, and you're not going to cast Jake Gyllenhaal, you mm-hmm know, as
sure
your lead.
Yeah.
Like, then
yeah, well, I just wasn't in the mood to cast him.
Well,
he's a little,
I'm just saying that's a different distribution scenario than sure than, you know, casting.
Right, but let's take distribution out of the equation for a second. Someone like Matt or like me that's going to make Blue Ruin meets Puffy Chair is trying to figure out, should I try to make this movie at $200,000 or at $2 million?
But that's why I say you have to take, like, the vast majority of filmmakers don't take distribution into account. They just say, we're going to make this movie because we're passionate about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we know we need stars, but either we can or we can't afford stars. And they don't think about what it actually takes to get a movie released, the cost implications mm-hmm for distribution. They don't think about things like SAG residuals. All of this is value. All of this is, you know, it commands a dollar being spent to $2 being
right
transacted. So you do have to think about these things.
Sure. Like, what specifically can a filmmaker do? Like, they hear you loud and clear, right? What are the steps that they get to take to figure out what that value is, right?
Well,
so it's like, okay, no Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yeah, but right? It's just like, do your research and be a consumer just as much as you are a filmmaker. If you want to fit within the echelon of, like, you know, Joe Swanberg or mm-hmm you know, like, guys of that
sure
quote unquote mumblecore, you know, community, Factory 25, like, you need to know what Factory 25. If you love mumblecore movies and you don't know what Factory 25 is or who Factory 25 is, you need to take a step back from thinking about making a mumblecore movie mm-hmm and find out who Factory 25 is. you need to look up guys like Ryan Keller over at Instrum International, you know, this boutique sales agency. And these are guys that transact on these pictures.
Mm-hmm.
You want your movie distributed. You want your movie in front of an audience.
So you're saying take a comp, right, and then figure out who the players are in that film's
atmosphere. Yeah. If you want your movie to be seen outside of, you know, Banff,
uh-huh,
like, it behooves you to know when, you know, the executives from Visit Films reach out to you and say, hey, we're interested in your picture. Like, you should know who these people are because you've done your research.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so that you're prepared to do business on your picture, because this happens almost on every single picture I've ever encountered, which is, we'll take an initial meeting, you know, hey, we want to make this because we're really passionate.
Right.
That's awesome. Go make your movie, man. Delivery occurs to us. We internalize. And at some point, right when they're done delivering, and they're like, well, how much money can we make this year?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how much? Can you write me a check, like,
yeah,
this
yeah
quarter?
I did it.
I need to get my investor their investment back. Well, fuck you for calling it an investment in the first place. Like, that word is so precious to me. Investment. Like, what did you actually invest? Did you invest $1 to make $2? Do you know anything about distribution? Like,
sure.
You know,
they're like, no, that's why you're here.
Yeah. But like, you know, that's like an actor saying to their agent, like, why aren't you getting me jobs? Like the actor, the agent doesn't get the job. Mm-hmm. The actor goes and auditions and then the agent negotiates the deal.
Right.
You know, we've all got connections here and there. So that's not the best example, but it's broadly true. Mm-hmm. Like even on a high level of operation in Hollywood, like, you know, Stallone's agent isn't getting Rambo set up at New Image. Mm-hmm. There are lots of other people in place that are doing that, including Sylvester Stallone himself. Yeah, an agent will shepherd your movie. You know, an agent will shepherd a deal. Mm-hmm. It will make sure that T's are crossed and I's are dotted. And when you know that ancillary rights deal for airline rights comes in, we know how to negotiate that so that when overages are due, we're collecting those in a timely manner and we're remitting them in mm-hmm. a timely manner. And yeah, I take my piece. I signed the good deal on your behalf. Like, anyways, so like if you're making a movie and you want to have it be seen by an audience means money. Like an audience, mm-hmm. every person has a dollar sign floating over their head. They're either willing to transact on your movie or they're not. Like that's the reality of it. You know, unless your goal is to have your movie seen by the broadest audience possible, then what's stopping you from uploading it to YouTube right now? Mm-hmm. You know, if that's all that's important to you. But I would argue that the guy or grandma who put up $75,000 for the picture with the promise of like, hey, grandma, it's a good idea. Check out what this movie Blue Ruin did. this is a huge amount. Look at the box office mojo on this. And then these 10 other pictures that.
Right, Napoleon Dynamite. Right.
Yeah, look at Paranormal Activity.
Yeah,
and
Blair Witch.
And Unfriended. I passed on Unfriended. Ooh, mistake yikes. There, but that's all right. But like,
well,
you know,
okay, well, so
but,
then,
but you have to like, if you're gonna invest money and then call it an investment, like you need to educate yourself on what the business is. Just like you need to know the 180 degree rule, or you know, mm-hmm. Like you need to know why an L cut works as opposed to a J cut in
sure.
certain circumstances.
But so let's assume though that you know. Our listeners are aware of that stuff, right? Like, mm-hmm. or rather, let's take a step back. Okay, so like, you know, somebody walks in, they've got their like their pitch deck, and it's got Blue Ruin in it, and it's got Napoleon Dynamite in it. And you're like, whoa, 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 let's pump the brakes here, because those comps don't make any sense to you. What should they do? What's the right path, right? Because like.
Yeah, people you're asking just, what movie is it like, but then when you hear Blue Ruin, you're like, well,
you're
that
like, well,
count.
That's the lightning in a bottle. Do you come in with a movie that you guys sold?
But that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying your movie, you know, saying my movie's like Blue Ruin is just fine. There's nothing wrong with that.
Uh-huh.
Expecting that your movie will do the same business that Blue Ruin did is a misaligned expectation.
So let's say that that's not the circumstance. They're just saying this is a tonal comp.
Okay, yeah.
Right, and they're not expecting that sort of business. Okay. So you're like, oh, great, I love that movie.
Mm-hmm.
What next? What's the next thing that you talk about?
Expectation. It's all about expectation.
So when you say expectation,
like that, yeah.
Is it like we made this movie for $500,000 and we'd like to make $1 million? Is
so
that
if,
an expectation?
Let's get more specific. But let's talk about like Blue Ruin. I know nothing about this movie other than what
sure,
I said.
Sure, sure. It's just a hypothetical.
But like
though.
You know, but like this movie, you know, the guys will say like, you know, Jeremy and his wife put, you know, everything on the line. Mm-hmm. They mortgaged their house or, you know, they put their entire savings into this picture. So if that filmmaker walks into my office and they're like, hey, it's, you know, it's like Blue Ruin. Awesome. Can't wait for it to, you know, do you have a festival plan? Okay, great. You've mm-hmm. got a festival plan. You submit it. All right. We'll see what happens there. Well, what's your expectation? Well, Jeff and Mike, I want you to know I mortgaged my house to finance this picture.
Sure.
And I'd be like, that's crazy. crazy.
So let's qualify expectation, right? Because I think what you're really saying is that there's a handful of different things that are expectations, right? There's the financial expectation, like what people are hoping to make their money back on, how quickly they're hoping to get paid out that money. And then also like the prestige of what their festival plan is and who they suppose the audience is for this movie and therefore what markets it was.
Yeah. Playing. So expectation, you know, in context in this conversation would be like, again, defining success. How do you right. define success? If the expectation is misaligned, then we don't take on the project, maybe to our detriment, because there's so many sales agencies that, you know, are opportunistic and have been opportunistic and then have found lightning in a bottle, and it's worked out tremendously for them. It's been, you know, there have been those situations that have changed lives in Hollywood.
Well, I'd love to just get, I know, I think we talked about expectations and definitions of success and all that stuff, but I'd love to get into just real specifics.
Sure.
That our listeners can take away, like, don't make a $10,000 horror film with no name actor. Like, and I know you don't want to get, you don't want to discourage anyone from doing anything, but I think it's helpful. So I guess starting off, can you tell us why you passed on Unfriended, that movie? And the Unfriended is like a, that's the kind of found, like,
it's
screens.
Like through the, through the camera of a laptop, you know,
it's thing. Like horror searching.
Films. Yeah.
Right. It's like all well, instant messages.
It was at a time where found footage was absolutely saturated. We couldn't go basically a single week without having somebody send us something that had a found footage aspect to it. So the horror genre is incredibly competitive. Found footage from a distributor standpoint, like from the people that we talk to, is almost like an anti-pitch point. It just says right off the bat, it says low budget, you know. Mm-hmm. And then Unfriended didn't have any star value to it. I think there's like a John Cho movie.
Searching.
That is now trying to kind of like buck that trend.
Yeah, yeah. It sold for $5 million at Sundance.
You know, and it can happen. And Unfriended went and did, you know, $11 million in its opening weekend or something. Like, you know,
yeah.
But we looked at those.
And by the way, Courtney Halverson, who was one of the leads in The Hammer, was in it. So it had some star value. Okay.
Sorry.
I'm just kidding.
But so we looked at that picture and I think, you know, Timur Bekmambetov was and like an executive producer mm-hmm. on it, and like so his
Hardcore
name was being
Henry? Is that that guy?
Or no?
Wanted director.
Wanted. Nine, the animated mm-hmm. thing. He did some. I think he made a picture for Roger Corman, like for one of his first pictures. But like that was it. Like that was the pitch point to mm-hmm. us. Was like, you should care about this laptop, the movie. Because it's Timur Presents, mm-hmm. you know, and we looked at that and we were just like, well, you know, he's great, but our buyer base is probably not going to respond to this. They probably put this in the bottom rung of consideration mm-hmm. and it would go for a bottom barrel price. And had that movie not received the studio release that it did,
with the massive marketing
budget. Right. Causing all that pre-awareness, and international would not have responded to that picture.
It felt budget. It felt cheap, you're saying.
Well, it just
in a market that's already seen a lot of
movies. Didn't stand out. Like it's a cool concept, but there's another, you know, Instrom has a picture called, I think, Zeros and Ones. Mm-hmm. And it's similar kind of concept. It's not a horror picture, but so what? Right. Like, it's still a laptop camera movie. Has anybody ever heard of Zeros and Ones outside of, you know, the people who watch those kinds of, you know, but like there was nothing driving Unfriended. And so, like, again, lightning in a bottle. Paranormal Activity was lightning in a bottle. So that's where it's like, I don't discourage the idea from the outset. Like Michael would say, you know, don't waste your time or, you know, focus on something else. But I can't do that. Like with a good conscience, having gone through what I've gone through and knowing now what I know, like,
You never know when you'll get lightning in a bottle.
Go make your unfriended. Why not? Because there are 1,000 more guys like me in Hollywood who are wrong, you know, and who will say no to unfriended. Sure. But then all you have to do is get it to that one person who says yes, and your life can change. So you want to go make Puffy Chair Makes Blue Ruin, like, go for
sure.
it.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
It doesn't make my job easy as a sales agent, though. And I think that's what you're driving at, is like...
Yeah, that is exactly what
makes my job easy.
And also, like, when you're in the... So you see a lot of movies after they've been filmed. But when you're at that spot where you're, like, trying to raise money for your movie and you're going to talk to people like you guys that, you know, might put a few $100,000 in or connect you with some investors or someone else that might put a couple $100,000 in, like, what's... Like, is Blue Ruin meets Puffy Chair, is that something that will not...
We wouldn't finance that picture.
Right.
I wouldn't put sales estimates on that picture.
Uh-huh.
Because it's execution dependent.
Because it's execution dependent. And like, even if it does premiere at South by Southwest to rave reviews, what sort of information can I really absolutely say this is why it's worth X number of dollars in France if you don't go theatrical, you know, unless the picture is wide release, whatever, right. Unless I can find that guy who's, you know, working with the government to bypass quota, whatever.
Right. And by the way, when I met with Jeffrey and Michael, why I thought they're interesting to talk to is because I think the way you guys look at movies before they're made, you and Michael wrote and directed some movies.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming you
that's interesting.
Came to those from your experience of what sells and doesn't sell.
The movies that we've been associated with making have been decisions based on contributing to our buyer base. Yes. They're purely financial plays, first and foremost. And every picture is different. Every circumstance is different. But to give you like the shorthanded answer to your question, those pictures that we did were always financial endeavors first and foremost. And our hope was that they turned out to be good movies. Like, right. You know, and we've submitted like some of the more recent ones, like we've submitted them to festivals. And if they get in and are validated, sure. Awesome.
Fine. Yeah.
Great. Was that our goal from the outset? No. But we know that festivals are a byproduct of movies being made. And so if a festival wants to embrace something, it turns into a win-win. But first and foremost, the pictures that we've financed or been involved with in a heavy financial way have been pictures that we knew we could make for a price and that we could sell for a profit. Mm-hmm. And that's not the right way. That's not the wrong way. That's just how we've done it.
Can you share with us some of the genres that like what are buyers looking for today?
I'll share. Yeah. First it depends on the buyer, because if your buyer is Factory 25, they're probably not looking for, you know, a Jean-Claude Van Damme, Dolph Lundgren two-hander. But if you're Saban, that's exactly what you're looking for. If you're Vertical Entertainment, you're looking for something that is remarkable. You're looking for something that adds to the value of your library, that shows a stream of talent that has star value but doesn't have to. It could be an execution-dependent thing. If you're Splendid in Germany, you're looking for A-list pictures to put in theaters, but you're also looking for...
A-list, you mean cast?
Yeah, yeah. You're looking for, like, you know, Hitman's Bodyguard 2. You're looking for... they distributed Hereditary. Mm-hmm. So you're looking... You know, they're looking for remarkable pictures to put in front of audiences, just like Vertical is.
Specifically with yours though.
But that's my point. Like every distributor is different. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what are distributors looking for? Well, there's a lot of different distributors.
Right. So did you say, okay, well, we've got these, we found like there's a common thread between a handful of these distributors, so it's a safe bet? Or how did you land on deciding to make the movie?
Yeah, usually what we do is we look for a gap in the marketplace, mm-hmm. first and foremost, is we say, you know, how can we contribute to our buyers? Because we're not necessarily, like I said, putting the movie in front of the audience itself. We're putting the movie in front of the people that put the movie in front of the audience. So we're saying, what do distributors need right now? You know, what's the gap? Okay, well, there's not enough, you know, Jean-Claude Van Damme and Dolph Lundgren two-handers. Let's make
one. Is that
one
of the movies you guys made?
No. Oh. It's one that recently released. Black Sight, I think is what it's called. But that's what we do, is we look for a gap in the market, and you know, from our buyer base. And usually we find some sort of compatibility between what the buyer base is looking for, what that gap is, and then let's say what major retailers or outlets are looking for too, because there's an audience demand for it. Usually there's been an alignment there, mm-hmm. is that, for example, we finished a movie, Snake Out of Compton. There is not a whole lot of content on Netflix in North America right now that appeals to a broad urban or Latino audience. I hope through the name Snake Out of Compton that mm-hmm. that like
we that, put two and two together.
Yeah, to like there's a method there, but also it was like it was a catchy name, and right. we knew, you know, it's catchy in the same
it's
way.
It's a
that,
horror film,
sure. It's horror, it's comedy,
horror comedy.
It's, you know, which is, by the way, the hardest genre to pull off, as far as
execution
like
wise.
Yeah. But the name value of something like Snake Out of Compton is an immediate attention grabber, because you get it like right off.
Right.
Either you get that title right off the bat, or this movie is not for you. Like, and I don't care whether you're a distributor or an audience. Like, it's
everybody gets it immediately.
Yeah, and if you don't, like, you know.
Right.
That's on you.
Hope you like your Rachmaninoff LPs.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's fine too. I like Rachmaninoff and NWA. But that's what we look for, is we look for gaps in the marketplace. You know, science fiction, horror, action, you know, these have global appeal, because mm-hmm. typically, you know, fear doesn't need a whole lot of colloquial translation. And ass kicking is universally understood. So it's not to say that like you have to make, you know, a movie with a shark sure. with three heads.
I mean, or like Oren's movie, right? Like, I guess maybe Oren's film came to you after it was already made, so it's a different sort of value proposition, right? But like Oren's is, you know.
I think we first became aware of it when you were production? Just starting out in production. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, could be.
And then whatever, 8 months.
We had like, you know, marketing was very much in our
initial plan. I guess that's true.
Plan.
Yeah, it was a clear sales pitch.
It was a true story about a UFC fighter who was a college championship wrestler and was deaf. Mm-hmm. And our backup plan was, if this movie is horrible and nobody wants to see it, at the very least, we know that the deaf market is severely underserved.
And
there's barely any deaf,
right.
Like literally when people, you ask deaf people who would be the most familiar with that market, like what great movies there are with deaf characters, they would say Children of a Lesser God, which is like a 30-year-old movie,
right.
Mr. Holland's Opus, which is like a 20-year-old movie, you know?
Yeah.
So we knew that, we also knew that deaf audiences specifically couldn't watch movies in the theater because they couldn't hear what the mm-hmm. people were saying, right. unless they were foreign films or subtitled. So that was like, That was like our worst case scenario. Not that ultimately we found out that, like a lot of audiences nowadays, deaf audiences weren't going to go spend that much money on our movie. But it was like we weren't just banking on it being a good movie. We were banking on here's like three very distinct audiences that we felt were underserved. Mm-hmm. Wrestling movies, UFC movies, deaf movies, you know. And we obviously, it's an indie film and biopic. It's inspirational. We never really thought we would be competitive in that market because the studios are competing in that market too. Mm. So that's kind of was our take on it.
I think a thing that I've heard you say a couple times, Jeffrey, is pitch points. Right?
Yeah.
Like, or pitch bullets, maybe. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So like I'm imagining that's something along the lines of like literally a little bullet point of like, here's the tiny concise blurb of here are the six different reasons why someone wants to buy this movie or watch this movie.
It's the, you know, sticker on the side of a car window. Right. You know, those are your pitch bullets.
It's like bang, bang, bang.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When a movie comes to you, give us examples of pitch points.
Then. I'll give you an example of one that came across my radar today, which was, Keanu Reeves, Ryui Kitamura, director, and $15 million budget, and $7.5 million of it was already shored up in private equity. So, like,
and that's it.
That was everything. And I was well, send me the script. Like, we're totally curious.
Is it made already?
No.
Oh, so they're pre-selling the other half.
They're looking for somebody to, shepherd the other half of the cash.
Right. So those categories, though, that's like, celebrity, right? Filmmaker with a track record.
And action. Action story.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's great. And then also...
We'll see. I'll read the script tonight.
Money is already...
50%.
...in the bank.
That's interesting. Yeah, or at least... Well, but even, let's say, you know, 7.5 of it was not shored up yet. It's still interesting to me because, like, $15 million, you know... Keanu is arguably, he's leading man status. He's people will go
in action movies.
Yeah, in an action picture, there's metrics there, just like there's metrics for Jason Statham. So like those are really strong pitch bullets. I mean, I don't know who else got that kind of email, you know, over the last week or two, but I'm sure all of them, like if they had good sense and they are interested in making that kind of movie, they would look at that and be like, yeah, let's take a look. Because even if, you know, Keanu drops out, even if Ryui Kitamura drops out, there are other people that can fill those spots that make that interesting, even at $15 million. But those were all the pitch bullets I needed to pique my curiosity.
Right. It lowers the execution dependence on a film like that.
That's a good knee-jerk reaction. But, you know, my perspective on it is it actually heightens it, because the worst thing in the world would be for that movie to like, you know, it's got great marketing. We all go see it on that Friday night, you know, get the babysit, whatever. It's like, we're going to go watch this movie opening weekend. And then we walk out of that theater like the people did on 47 Ronin. Mm-hmm. And then we're like, that movie was it was a mess. Like, so I think on
it's more fun to talk shit about a bad Keanu Reeves movie.
Right. So like the stakes for actually doing something of quality are higher. And I think that's just how you have to approach projects these days, is like, you know, what am I going to contribute? Because anybody can go out there and make a mediocre picture. It's not hard, but why not try and raise the bar? So if that script, isn't action, if it turns out to be more of like it's kind of a drama, kind of a thriller thing, I'm not going to be that interested because I think like my buyers will want to see, you know, the equivalent of John Wick, but not John Wick.
Right.
You know,
well, let me just ask you one last question before we wrap up. And it's when people are pitching to you, like when I pitched to you last week, what's like the litmus test? Like to you, obviously one of the important things is like, sell me a character that starts one way and ends another way.
That's huge. I mean, watching a character undergo change is massive. Again, you know,
and it can't be subtle, right? Because I was like, well, he's this guy that's not very ambitious, and by the end he's like more ambitious.
Absolutely. I like movies where characters change. You know, there's an argument that could be said, well, how does Ripley change, you know, in Alien? Like,
sure.
You know, but again, I would tell you, like, even though I've read those, you know, those articles about how Ripley doesn't change, I think she undergoes a profound change, personally. She goes from a crew member to sole survivor. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a change. She goes from a subordinate crew member to, like, you know, creator of her own destiny now, you know, to the lead. Yeah. I would question almost anybody who says, like, there are great movies where characters don't change. I would be like, just take a step back and actually give that statement the benefit of the doubt and mm-hmm. figure out. The real work would be, like, it's easy to say the character doesn't change. Figure out how they do change. Like, and then, because change is, I mean, that's drama, right? That's like, that's the essence of drama, is a character fighting against change. That's why you want to see a story, you know, to the end, is to see, did they actually learn something? So if your characters don't change, if the world doesn't, you know, change, it's not that you shouldn't make the movie. You should just take a big look at what it is that you're actually trying to tell, you know. If there's a giant, you know, ship that crashes into an iceberg, that's kind of fun to watch too.
Right.
Yeah. But change is definitely important. Cast is definitely important. You know, the first question that, you know, DirecTV or Netflix or Amazon, you know, buyers will ask is, when you present a title and you don't have key art, you know, mm-hmm. to show them, they'll be like, well, who's in it? So cast is absolutely important. Good casting is just as important as casting the biggest name. Would Hereditary have been better or more marketable if, you know, Sandra mm-hmm. Bullock had been the mom? I don't know. You know,
yeah.
Who's to say? But Tony was just fantastic in that picture, as you know, for performance. Is Sandra Bullock more a stronger sales scenario? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know.
Well, let me ask you this kind of final thought. In terms of tangible takeaways for people, say they want to go talk to you about financing a film, what are the things that they walk in with? What do you want to see?
Passion.
Uh-huh. Okay.
For what it is that they're doing. Passion is absolutely infectious. So even if it's the worst idea, and it's called Snake out of Compton, I'll still be interested.
Sure, you'll still check
because
it out.
You know, because the passion's there to make a movie as raunchy and funny and crazy as possible. Nothing would be worse than to have somebody come in and be like, well, you know, it's good for business.
Right. But do you need to,
because I'll come up with those ideas myself. Right, thanks. Right. Like, I know what's good for business.
Do you like a log line, a poster, walking you through every, you know, first, second, third act?
We'll take almost anything. Going back to like the beginning of this conversation, like less is more typically. Mm-hmm. So like if it's a cold email, typically I like to be, you know, courted. Yeah. Where it's like, hey, Keanu Reeves, are you interested? Yes.
Right. Something
Keanu Reeves and Ryui Kitamura. But $50 million. Like, yeah, I'll take, yes, feed me, you know, and that's exactly what this guy did today, where he was like.
And is there something that would get you that excited without like an A-list attachment?
Oh yeah. Again, you know, if it starts with passion, like, dear Automatic Entertainment, I just mortgaged my house because I have to make this movie. I'm going into production, and it's a revenge thriller about two warring families, and it's going to be bloody as fuck. Something that is like wildly unique or outside the box is definitely interesting. Competence in delivery is important too, or being able to trust somebody to actually follow through with their execution. That they know their strengths or weaknesses is important in a meeting or in an approach. Because if, you know, somebody has a great idea, but they have no background on how to execute it, but it's a great idea, then like be clear with that, you know. There's no reason to shy away from the team aspects of what filmmaking is. Mm-hmm.
Cool.
But just make good movies. Like, that's it. Make good movies. The cream will rise to the top.
Love it. Well, shall we move into unpaid endorsements?
Oh,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Unpaid endorsements.
Number one, is, I think it, this might have, I don't remember if this came out of a conversation with you guys or not. But I've heard a few people mention like John Truby's book on Anatomy of Story.
Yeah,
you,
we talked about that. Mike, yeah. Mike's been reading that, rereading it or something over the last like week. Because we're like during the summers, we move into development, you know.
Okay.
And so we were talking about that during our meeting.
Yeah, that must be it. So I had, we had this video essayist that had, that references him a lot on before Michael, and he mentioned it, and I've heard people mention it here and there, and then you guys mentioned it the other week, and I was like, I should read this Anatomy of Story, especially because I'm working on two different projects right now actively. You know, I'm at that spot where the, I have like a few options of where I can go in my third act, and I want to make sure I'm choosing the right direction,
sure.
which is probably not something I shouldn't be worried about. I should probably just choose a direction, and then if it doesn't work, change it, as opposed to just being afraid to move forward. But anyway... So I started reading that. I've only read the first chapter, but I'm enjoying it very much so far.
Truby's great. I mean, it's another one of those like kind of screenplays are format, you know, based books. So 22 points, you know, John Truby's 22 story beats, and you know, Blake Snyder's Save the Cat, you know, beats, and Joseph Campbell's, you know, Hero's Journey. Like they're all compatible
sure.
in a way.
Right.
So it's just giving different, I look at it as like just giving different kind of like headers
right.
to the different sections, but they're,
well, it's like inspiration of like how to think about a part. And I'm like,
yeah,
I have
how to organize your
for
thoughts.
Me,
right?
Yeah. It's so easy for a feature to just spit out everything I'm thinking up until the midpoint. And that's when I'm like, now what? Like now I've said all this stuff. I mean, you know, the John August and Craig sure. Mazin from Script Notes, they always talk about like, don't start your script unless you know the ending. And I'm like, well, maybe I'll find my ending if I start
sure.
the script, you know?
Yeah, there is that thing of like, well, if I just start writing, I'll get there. And, you know, I think it's different for every person. I think like
absolutely.
Figuring out what your process is
yeah,
is kind of
process.
Just the whole deal.
Well, so the other thing I was going to mention is... there's this political ad for MJ Hager. Have you guys seen it? She was like running for Senate, I think, in Texas.
Yeah, it went viral. Is that
yeah.
one? Yeah.
And she was in the Air Force and she was a pilot and she has this whole theme of doors. And she made this like 3.5 minute ad about how she lobbied to let women be part of ground forces in the military. And she did all these things and she's running against the governor of Texas now, who was one of the people that was...
literally said no to her.
Literally wouldn't talk to her, according to her, because she was wasn't a donor. You know, who knows like how everything is presented. But this ad went viral because, you know, it's a real interesting story, and she's got an interesting story. I'm sure a lot of people that are running for office have interesting stories. But the production value is like really high, and it's really high, but it's not like mind blowing if you look at it compared to like Hereditary or something, right? So it's just, I don't know, sometimes it's nice to have a reminder that there's these other formats of video that you can work in, that if you just have like a high production value, like something that we could all achieve if we spent the time and energy to do it, like you could get noticed. Like there's more places to kind of get to the forefront of like your directing and filmmaking than just like feature films and TV shows and
sure.
Sundance short films. Like I was thinking, if I got the job to make this ad, would I have done all these like awesome Steadicam moves
right.
and
would
like,
I've
cool
been
transitions
so
and
thoughtful?
Would I have like fought so hard, or would I have been like, it's a political ad, get in front of this white psych and say your dumb words? So it
we'll
just kind of
interview you in your office,
right? Yeah. Just kind of reminded me like how if you can be passionate about even like a political ad for like a local, you know, politician, then people will notice, and that's like those are the type of people that. You know, rise to the top. And it's, you know, Rhett and Link, who made these like amazing ads for like local businesses, like got super big. So I don't know. It's just kind of inspirational and just the production value of this political ad.
Yeah. Yeah. So my unpaid endorsement is I have been this last week working a ton on kind of like documents for this show that I've sold. And like basically like a leave behind, like a two pager. So like they bought the pilot. Everything's great. Everybody loves it. But I'm kind of back in that Bible mode, basically. Right.
So you're working on the Bible or on the Leave Behind?
It's like a little bit of a, it's kind of this strange document, which is why it's brand new. It's not by any means like a full Bible, but it's got kind of like a manifesto sort of feel to it. It's kind of like the Leave Behind of like, in the circumstance where someone isn't going to have time to read the entire pilot, this is kind of like their primer, basically. And so it has to feel spicy and fun and evoke the world and, you know, kind of all
of
that stuff.
Are there images?
There are images. So it's a little bit decky, but mostly is just text, right? So it's a kind of a strange document that, like, I haven't, especially at this point in the process, you don't normally have to write this. It's kind of, it feels more of like a sales tool. And it is a sales tool because we'll be taking it out to other buyers, basically. But so the point is that, like, I'm working on this document and I felt a little rusty. Like, we had Spencer Griffin, and we talked about, like, the difference between being able to write a great script and then write an essay about why your script is great are two totally different disciplines. And the thing that always helps me get back into that mode is I have a few documents that I like to reread that are inspiration points for me. So, like the Paul Feig has like a excerpt of like the Freaks and Geeks Bible that I'll reread, and it's like very conversational, like very deep into like the ethos of all of the different characters. And then, you know,
and it's like funny too.
It's
right?
funny and it's fun, but the point is like have a document that kind of can jumpstart that process for you. And so that's my endorsement. It's relatively abstract, but if you have a few reference points that you can fall back on to get you in the right headspace, that can be a really invaluable thing.
And you don't find that you're just like kind of copying a style?
No, I mean, I couldn't if I tried, but also like, you know, it's about a show that's 20 years old now. So like, I'm not too worried about it.
Right.
Yeah.
I had this thing where I'd like read a bunch of commercial treatments while mm-hmm. I was pitching commercial treatments, and a couple of them that I really liked, like, you know how commercials work, right? You have a call with the agency, you talk about the script, and then you write a treatment based on it. So this treatment I really liked, the director kept referring to the call. You know, what we said on the call was this, and I loved what you guys said on the call. And I was like, that's like so casual. Mm-hmm. Like, it's expecting the reader to have so much context. So I like my next treatment was all about that. It was like, I loved what you guys said on the call. You know, when Mike said this, it made me think of this thing. And I sent in the treatment and everyone's like, who's Mike? What call? Like what? Like, this is so confusing. And I realized like, oh, I was just literally copying what the way this other director
right,
talks.
Right. Yeah,
I was
like copying the style too much. Yeah.
So I pulled back on it. I got kind of negative feedback on that from a few people. So I just stopped doing that altogether. But it reminded me that you don't have to be so formal in your writing. Anyway, cool. That's a good endorsement.
A little spice to it. Yeah.
Giles.
Okay. All right. Just because I've been kind of getting back into this on my commutes in the morning is video essayists on YouTube. I love listening to these guys, like just discovering, it's almost like a rabbit hole. So like lessons from the screenplay and,
sure,
you know,
that's
Nerd Writer
the guy
One.
We had on.
Oh, you had, yeah, that I wondered. So yeah. Like, yeah, that guy's genius. I would love for him to write a script and send it my way.
Yo, if Michael, if you are listening, so he's down, I'm
so
sure.
Here's,
I know he's down.
So here's my challenge, like to guys who are listening to Lessons from a Screenplay or Channel Criswell, or I don't think Nerd Writer One Evan is probably interested in writing a script at any point, but Jack's Movie Reviews, and there's more, and I'm not mentioning their names because I forget some of their names or I don't want to say it right, wrong. But I like these guys are profoundly amazing. And I think if there were filmmakers out there who are really internalizing what some of these guys are saying and paying attention to the videos that these guys are making and adhering to their advice, we should be in a wave of really amazing content coming out within the next 5 years.
Didn't... the guy who did Columbus was a video essayist first. I can't remember his name now.
Well, but, I just look at these guys as like the, you know, Cahiers du Cinéma, like, mm-hmm. you know, yeah, those, yeah. like French New Wave. these are our guys, like, yeah, today, yeah. You know, so huge, huge kudos to the research that they're doing and the amount of time that they're putting into these videos. Even things like, what's it called? Wisecrack, Garrick Swarmuloid. Like, have you heard of it?
I don't know this guy? One, no.
Earthling Cinema, that's what it's called. Oh, he's hilarious too. But, like, you know, they'll take you know, these movies and then they'll break them down, and he breaks it down in a funny way, and then he'll actually dive into, like, what is Old Boy trying to say to you? You know, what are the thematic elements here? And it really, like, dives into film theory and criticism stuff, and it's just great. And he does it in a way that's, you know, perfect for YouTube. And
but don't you think that stuff is just, like, reflective? Like, they're not creating. It's so different to analyze films than to write films.
Sure. But that's why I'm like, you know, if these guys have any inclination to actually...
And it is creative. I didn't mean it's not creative. I meant that...
Sure.
Finding interesting connections in film.
Recognizing theme versus creating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or just knowing why a story or movie works. Like, just on a basic level, or in the most, you know, deepest hidden meanings, you know, sort of way. I just think these people are unbridled geniuses, mm-hmm. that just need to get their stories out. Some, if they have that ambition, like, I think they've tapped onto something, and Hollywood should sit up and pay attention. And
sure.
And
I think Michael's the one that did the Dark Knight one.
Yeah.
He said people, like, are constantly telling him that studio execs are referencing his Dark Knight video. Why it's a perfect villain or something.
Yeah, right? that one, that's his big breakout. And I remember I had lunch with my lawyer the day that we were interviewing him, and he brought it up. Like, yeah, apropos, right. I wasn't like, oh, yeah, I wasn't talking about the podcast. He was like, oh, have you seen this great video on why villains are so important?
Yeah, like, I think, yeah. You know, these guys are important, and you should support them on Patreon.
Yeah. Speaking of which, if you want to support us on Patreon, go to patreon.com/justshootitpod. If you want to email us, you can email us at justshootitpod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your feedback, questions. If you got any questions for Jeffrey Giles, we will forward your email to him.
Our information's very public. We're not hard to find.
If you mention Keanu Reeves, he'll probably read it.
I'll probably open that email.
You can follow us on Twitter at Just Shoot a Pod, on Instagram, Facebook, everywhere. We'd love to get a review from you on iTunes. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Smitey Pyleg.
And I'm at Mr. Matt Venlo. You can give us a voicemail at 2626-SHOOT-1. We'd love to hear your questions on the air. This episode was edited by Christopher Robert Gray. Our webmaster is Ewan Williams. It's produced by Madeline Rosewatt. And the music is provided by the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar.
And if you want to find out more about Michael, check out Automatic with a C Entertainment on Google, and you'll find everything they've ever done.
Awesome. Cool. Thanks, man.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.